You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, July 30th, 2020. I'm Matt Leck. This is a Matt, Brendan, Jamie, and Matt Thursday, broadcasting probably closer to the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal than ever before in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a throwback Michael interview with Mark Ames that aired before my time on the Majority Report. On Seymour Hersh and the difficulty of investigating private power in America. Also on the program, Donald Trump wants to postpone democracy until he can figure out what the hell's going on. That news came via his Twitter minutes after it was announced that GDP contracted at a record 32.9%. As jobless claims rise to 1.3 million, not good, folks. Bloomberg reports 30 million Americans didn't have enough to eat last week. Also, the USA passes the 150,000 death mark and is registering about a coronavirus death a minute. One of those coronavirus-related deaths, TPUSA co-founder Bill Montgomery, the man who convinced Charlie Kirk to become a propagandist instead of going to college. Another one of those deaths, Herman Cain, who appeared maskless at Trump's Tulsa rally. Also, the Trump administration continues the aggressive effort to undermine the United States Postal Service in an attempt to tenderize it for future privatization. Also, Trump attempts to spark a suburban race panic using the specter of public housing. And a new report from the Harvard Law Human Rights Program finds that since Evo Morales was deposed in Bolivia, quote, state-sponsored violence, restrictions on free speech, and arbitrary detentions have all contributed to a climate of fear and misinformation that has undermined the rule of law as well as the prospects of fair and open elections. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Folks, happy to be here with you today. I'm a little bit unhappy about the circumstances. We're going to do the Michael Rewind starting today. Brendan's with me. Hey,
Matt,
Brendan.
That was excellent. That was a home run. And, you know, I think Michael would be proud, but also a little intimidated by your performance there.
A little threatened, maybe.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be the super producer, not the super host. We don't have much for ads today. We'll play a clip afterwards. We'll have Jamie Peck and the previous Matt that there she is on the fun half today. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, you know what would be really funny if we just took this whole thing over and called it Peck Leck Productions?
Oh, man.
Nice.
You know, that reminds me of the time I tried to give myself a nickname in seventh grade, because I was kind of good at free throws in basketball. I shouldn't share this on the first broadcast, but Otto Matlek, I thought, was a...
What?
Yeah, Peck Leck and Finder Productions. That's pretty good.
Finder.
more of these zingers in the fun half, folks.
Yeah, really bad, but... Oh man, I'm making myself
Matt Leck,
blush.
That's pretty good.
God, it's so bad. Just thinking that to myself as I shot, like, you know, a little bit above average on free throws.
When I was in eighth grade, I won the Knights of Columbus three throw competition in Bergen County, New Jersey.
Knights of Columbus, exactly the same people who administrated my free throw competitions,
nice.
Brendan.
Very interesting.
Wait, so can we back up for a second? Otto Matt Leck, is this like a reference to a basketball thing that I don't understand, or are you trying
to say? So the idea is, you know what, the free throw in basketball, when you get fouled, you get to take two free throw shots. You wear this much?
Sure.
Well, basically, I consider myself automatic at those because I was quite good at them. So I would always like to get fouled so I can make those free throws. The pressure didn't get to me.
Okay, so it is a play on automatic.
It is. Oh, yes. That's.
I was like, is there some like better fitting pun that I is just going over my head or okay?
No, oh, I mean, that's cool. I was, you know, like I said, this was my teenage years, so the pun, the witticisms weren't quite there yet. But
wow, getting personal. I love it. I'm here for it.
Yeah, but anyway, let's move on to the actual show today. I want to introduce this. This is. An interview Michael did with Mark Ames, who's actually appeared on TMBS this year. But this was the first time. So I was probably a 6 month or so. This was June 8th, 2015. I was probably a 6 month or so Majority Report listener at this time. I was working as a researcher at Vice News. And it was, to be honest, I don't want to offend Matt Binder, but Michael and Matt days, I kind of checked out on. They weren't always regular downloading for me. I appreciate, this is about the time I was growing to appreciate their contributions and their day in a way that made me listen to it every time. It's true that by the time I started in Majority Report in October of 2015, that I was pretty much an everyday listener. This interview that Michael did with Mark Ames on Seymour Hersh and the dangers of corporate muckraking is really interesting to me. And I think about it a lot because it's a lot easier to frankly investigate public power in this country than private power. FOIA is actually good. It can get results, even though, you know, the CIA could just ignore it if they want to, or any of these agencies can. But corporations, that's the real deep state, folks. You don't know what's going on in there. I really, really liked this interview that Michael did. It's about, I think, like 25 minutes long. Then they switch over and Matt Binder does an interview. And we'll come back at that point and we will go to the fun half. But everybody, the show needs your support. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. That's where you can support this show. And also, Michael would want me to say patreon.com/TMBS so we can continue that project going. I'm going to start sharing the screen now, unless you guys have any final thoughts, and we will start playing this interview.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mark Ames. He's a senior editor at Pando. How you doing, Mark?
Good. How you doing?
Doing really well, man. And I should just say, as a heads up to our listeners, Mark is joining us from the field. And by field, I mean a park. By his apartment where he is needed to and has been so generous, frankly, to sort of get away from his family and his amazing newborn to join us for a little while. So appreciate it, man.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. My son has already said he's going to remember you forever for this. But
really?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
a long memory.
I love it.
Pissed off.
Yeah, of course he's pissed off. yeah. I appreciate that. So there'll be some, we could make probably some type of like gangster grudge match vehicle about, you know, between me and your son. I'm open to it.
Be careful. He's big. He's already big. So be careful.
I'm careful, but I'm crafty. So you have this really, really interesting new piece in Pando called Seymour Hersh and the Dangers of Corporate Muckraking. And what I liked so much about this piece is it hits a lot of themes that you hit a lot, Mark, which is sort of like really sort of shedding light on why is it easier on both the left and right to sort of expose government malfeasance, which is important. You're in no way diminishing or undermining the importance of those stories. But there's also this corporate power, this corporate corollary, and all of these issues we talk about that isn't addressed in the same way. Is that another kid?
It is. It's yeah. Park kid.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So you explained Seymour Hersh. The way the story starts is basically in Seymour Hersh's sort of heyday in the 1970s. He's exposed the My Lai massacre. He's at the New York Times, and he wants to take on corporate power. Take us from there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just, it started with me actually being curious. Why hasn't this, you know, the most bloodthirsty, aggressive, impressive muckraker, as they call him of our time, like, why hasn't he gone after corporate private power the way he has after government public power? Knowing that muckraking, you know, the original muckrakers went almost you know, more so than after government power, they went after private corporate power, which right. rose up in the late 19th century. Rockefeller, Standard Oil, the coal companies, so on and so forth. And so I wondered that, and I looked, and there is actually a story about what happened. Seymour Hersh, you know, he was considered hit politically very much on the left. Abe Rosenthal used to call him my little commie. Sort of ironically, affectionately in the newsroom at the New York Times. And it turned out that Hersh himself decided after, you know, after the My Lai expose and after the really big expose on CIA domestic spying in 75, the MHK chaos program, in which the CIA illegally, you know, spied on probably up to hundreds and thousands of Americans,
right.
Leading to the Church Committee and all that. He said after that, okay, the next big story in the next 10 years is corporate power. And, you know, the thing you have to remember is that back then, and his biographer talked about this too, in the 70s, the basic assumptions were very different about, private corporate power versus government power. The basic assumption, people were far more openly, and the culture was more openly skeptical of, and if not hostile towards corporate power.
Right.
And it was much more on the front and center of people's thoughts. You know, today you have all these, like, bizarre assumptions that somehow private power, corporate power, is not as dangerous as government power. As if, for example, one of the falsehoods I hear a lot, oh, well, companies, private companies can't put you behind bars the way a government can. That's just BS. I mean,
they operate private prisons, for God's sake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not only they operate them, but they constantly work with law enforcement to put people behind bars all the time. I mean,
right.
I wrote about eBay doing this. Like the head of the security for eBay at one conference with a bunch of police and FBI people bragged about how eBay in just a short period of time had put away, thousands of arrests around the globe with their global security force. Anybody who knows anything about the PayPal 14 knows that eBay PayPal ran the prosecution. I mean, it's a pretty shocking case if you ever read it. They ran the whole prosecution of that case against the PayPal 14.
So circling back to Hersh for a minute, to get back to the story.
Yeah.
I think that that's a really interesting point, though, just a side note, that he, in the 70s, even with this very different attitude, he was anticipating the environment and the climate of the 70s and 80s, which would set the stage for the assumptions you're talking about today, which was the kind of neoliberal backlash. And that was the sort of empowerment of corporations. So he saw it as a perceptive muckraker and journalist in the 1970s.
He had a nose for where coercive power was. And coercive power is both in the, you know, in the military and in intelligence areas in the government, and then in these huge new growing corporations. And so he chose to go after what was a very infamous company of its time in the 60s and 70s called Gulf and Western.
Gulf and Western to us a little bit. I mean, you got this mafia-connected lawyer who's involved in it. It's amazing. I mean, just bring out that company a little bit. Bring it to life a little bit. And because it's also just a great target for anybody who has a sense of what a good story is. I mean, it's mind-blowing, the power and reach of this company and the intimacy between, you know, the criminal economy and the corporate economy. There's a lot to it.
And the characters. I mean, it had great characters. And it shows, again, you know, that Hersh has always had a great nose for a good story. The problem, as I'll tell you in a minute, was what happens when you try to write about corporate power. You have to bring in the lawyers and the editors in a way you don't have to when you write about government. So in any event, Gulf and Western began in the 50s as an auto parts company. And it was run by this guy who was the New Yorker in the 90s after he was dead, called the last great business eccentric. His name was Charlie Bluedorn. He was also known as the Mad Austrian. He was originally from Austria. He had a lot of energy and he was, you know, notoriously aggressive as hell and scary. And he wound up striking up basically a really good relationship first with with Chase Bank, and then with Hanover Manhattan, I think was the other one. Mm-hmm. Manufacturers Hanover, I'm sorry. And these banks basically, they open up the spigot for him to finance an acquisition spree. And the banks made money kind of on both ends, because the more, like, they would have clients on one end and then Gulf and Western on the other end, and they would make money off both ends on the deals. So they were encouraged to really keep financing these acquisitions that he would make. And he wanted to do it because his stock price would go, the more he would acquire, the more value his company had, and the more his stock price went up, and the more leverage he would then get over the banks to pull out personal loans. I mean, it was a very, very convoluted and, fraud-ridden.
It sounds very modern.
It does, but, yeah. You start to think about what the banks did here in the 2000s, or what the SNLs did. I mean, they basically load up.
Yeah.
On borrowed money and then turn it into their personal ATM. That's kind of what he did,
right?
With Gulf and Western. And, he really attracted a lot of attention when he bought Paramount Pictures in 66, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 68, he attracted more attention when he cut this very strange deal with one of the most notorious mafia financiers, of the 20th century, Michele Sindona. Michele Sindona was, he ran the money laundering for the Sicilian Mafia's global heroin operations. He was also known as God's banker because he had the ear of one of the popes, and he managed the Vatican's global properties. He also helped the CIA move money around the world. And in 68, 69, he cut a deal with Gulf and Western, which, by the way, was considered, Gulf and Western was so aggressive that Wall Street nicknamed them Engulf and Devour. And if you've ever seen that Mel Brooks movie, Silent Movie, the evil corporation in it was called Engulf and Devour, as a movie from the mid-70s.
Right.
In any event, one of the companies, subsidiaries that Gulf and Western bought, I think it was called Commercial something or other, anyway, New Hampshire company. It was totally worthless, and it was creating a problem for the books, for Gulf and Western's books. So somehow they managed to swap how many millions of dollars worth of totally worthless commercial paper in the subsidiary with Michele Sindona's Italian finance company, a 10% stake in that company. And then they swapped back half of Paramount Pictures' movie lot back to Sindona. And then they asked Sindona about it afterwards, and he said, I like to give pieces of companies undervalued to friends who I want to do favors for. I mean, it just makes, like, no sense whatsoever.
Unless you're a Sicilian financier, then that might make some sense.
Yes, exactly. And this was just one of the many shady schemes that Hirsch wound up getting into. Another one is they own basically the largest employer in the Dominican Republic, where, the U.S. has been intervening militarily and otherwise, throughout the whole century. And they basically, they own the sugar business there, Gulf and Western did. They own the sugar refinery. They were the largest employer. And they, when the Dominican Republic Central Bank needed more money on its books, Gulf and Western would illegally funnel money their way against SEC rules. And when Gulf and Western needed more money on its books, to try to boost the share, the Dominican Republic Central Bank would funnel money back into their accounts. It was all just, it was crazy. So
you have everything. You have mafia. Yeah. You have incredible, just sort of rampant corporate criminality. You have our policy of coup and dictatorship in Latin America. And then seeing the trend of corporate power. So Hirsch sees all of this, and this is going to be his next major expose.
Exactly. So he goes to the New York Times and says, this is going to be the big story. Like, I've already proven I have a nose for this stuff. I have a Pulitzer. Corporate power, and this company embodies everything that's wrong with overweening corporate power in this country. These guys are now the 19th largest employers. They're violating every rule in the book. They're not using the money to sort of innovate and grow and do something good. They're actually just using the money as personal ATMs. And so he gets to go ahead. Everybody's totally for it. And he winds up hooking up with Jeff Gerth, who's now at ProPublica. Mm-hmm. I think he did like the Whitewater. I think he first broke the Whitewater stories in the 90s. Anyway, and they wound up spending, you know, a very long time digging into Gulf and Western and all of the problems they're having. And there was a lot of buildup, like, oh, my God, Hirsch is going after corporate America now. And there's a lot of, like, anticipation of the story, what would happen when it finally came out. And in mid-1977, they finally released a series. It was a three-part series, 13,000 words in total. And it landed with a whimper, an absolute whimper. The stories are dull, turgid. Mm. Everything a Seymour Hirsch story is not, you know. And then you start going back into, well, why? How did that happen? Why did the stories have so little effect, and why are they so unreadable and such a disappointment? And well, then we found out the whole process Hirsch had to go through to even get these stories published. And what happens is, I mean, when you're a journalist and you want to go after a company, first of all, companies can do a lot more to journalists. They can threaten you in far bigger and worse ways overtly.
Explain that a little bit. That's because I think people, again, intuitively, they'd say, well, wait a second. If you're going up against the NSA or the CIA or, you know, a covert intelligence or military organization that has, you know, vast surveillance powers, is involved in all sorts of extrajudicial things, how can a corporation have more overt power? It makes total sense to me, but, you know, tease that out a little bit.
Well, I mean, first of all, they're considered people,
right? There you
right,
go.
And you know, under our laws, and the government is constrained by the Constitution. The government is constrained by the Constitution that, you know, that's what we're all, you know, worried about these days. That, you know, it shouldn't be able to surveil you. I mean, somebody can hire a private detective,
right?
Right, and it's, I mean, it's legal. Maybe you can sue them, but you can't. If you can prove some kinds of damages to your life, you can maybe sue them.
Really quick. So basically, just, I mean, I want you to fill it, but like an example would be like if the FBI or the CIA send people to follow and monitor a journalist who's covering them, that's a big deal. A corporation can hire any private contractor they want to do anything they want. Short of obviously like physical harm, but they can go through somebody's garbage. They can, you know, that's par for the course.
Well, and as Hirsch and the people writing about Hirsch's story said in the 70s as well, the things that Gulf and Western said and did, I mean, they openly threatened Hirsch many times. They did everything to try to get him and Jeff Gerth fired. They openly told Hirsch, you know, we're digging up information on your families and on Jeff Gerth's father that's going to be very damaging. He told him that straight up. No fear whatsoever. Now, and as they said at the time, everybody said, if that happened in the government, you'd have resignations. You'd have a huge ongoing, you know, story, and then you'd have people resigning. Nobody in private government, and let's call them private government, this is what they are, resigns over that. And they don't, and, you know, it's assumed these days, our cultural assumption is that their only, fealty is only to, and their only responsibility is to their shareholders to maximize profit. They don't have any responsibility to, you know, to the public whatsoever. And they don't have to. They're not constrained by the Constitution. So, you know, what Hirsch found out was that going after these guys, the threats of lawsuits were so great. I mean, the NSA, you know, the CIA couldn't threaten, didn't threaten to sue, you know, the New York Times over Hirsch exposing the, you know, the domestic spying program. They weren't going to, like, sue the New York Times out of existence. And, in fact, the New York Times had already won, you know, landmark First Amendment rights cases in the Supreme Court about its right to publish the Pentagon Papers and other classified documents. So, you know, the New York Times knew that it's protected against the public government power, but it's not protected. And we all know this. Every journalist knows this. Every journalist knows that, you know, you might fear in the back of your head that the government could do something secretly without you ever knowing that could screw up your life, you know, or there's a fear that they'll kill you or, you know, whatever. But we know that they are actually constrained, and they can't get away with it. But with private corporations, first of all, you can't FOIA them,
right.
And good luck suing them. I mean, what's Jeff Gerth going to do? Sue Gulf and Western for threatening him? You know, who's got the money for that?
Right.
These guys were clearly ready to go all out to make life hell for them, and they did. And so the New York Times, unlike any of his stories on the CIA or the My Lai massacre, anything. They held up the story. They made it go through. They have lawyers vetting it in ways that none of his stories about government were vetted. They had editors. They put a team of editors on it. They were threatened, you know, repeatedly. Hearst himself said that the experience from Gulf and Western's executives and their lawyers and the abuse that he put up with and the threats that he put up with was unlike anything by far that he had ever dealt with when investigating the CIA or the military. He'd never dealt with anything like it, and he didn't want to repeat the experience again. He was destroyed by it.
Yeah.
The article came out like crap, and he just thought, you know, as a career move, it's a bad career move. It's not worth it to fight corporate power. And so he never wrote about corporations again after that. He went back to writing about Henry Kissinger. You know, we all hate Henry Kissinger, and there's no fear of the sort of retaliation that he had to deal with when writing about, Gulf and Western.
Well, and for what it's worth, for all of the writing about Henry Kissinger that's sort of been exhaustively done, there's not as much, you know, written about his private consulting work. And even so, what's fascinating about the article too is that, you know, these articles, as sort of boring and as pared down as they became, actually did have an effect on Hirsch's target and on Gulf and Western. So even that said, it still had some impact. And I guess
eventually. Yeah. It just wasn't the dramatic impact
right.
that people expected. I mean, you know, again, the big series he did before that, the CIA domestic spying program, had the greatest effect, I think, besides the Watergate stories,
right.
the greatest effect of pretty much any, you know, muckraking of our time, which was the Church Committee hearings and the Pike Committee hearings and the Rockefeller Commission. I mean, it was that, you know, rippled for years afterwards. And I think Hirsch's bad experience and the New York Times' bad experience going after corporate power and going after Gulf and Western in such a deep, profound way. You know, I mean, he wasn't just going after one thing they did. He really went after, it's kind of fascinating, he went after the companies, both their sort of the wrongdoings, but also kind of structurally,
right.
you really got, he peeled the whole thing open. And, you know, corporations want to live in secrecy.
Yeah.
As do spy agencies. I mean, that's, I think, another thing that attracted him to this. And he really kind of peeled it open. You got to look at a conglomerate on a lot of different levels in a way that hadn't been done before and really hasn't been done since. One of the things I think I'm learning writing about corporate power here in the technology sector and having looked, you know, and having written a bit about certainly like the Koch brothers and finance, is how little we actually understand about the architecture of corporate power today. I think it's definitely a lot different from the conglomerate architecture that Hirsch wrote about. I mean, that was a new thing in the 60s and 70s. The conglomerates were then destroyed. It's a whole nother story, but they kind of went by the wayside and new structures kind of came up in the years since then. And we don't understand anything. We do not even, no one could tell you the structure of Google or Facebook. I mean, the full structure, eBay, you know, Coke Industries for that matter. Like, no one can tell you the structure of it. There are no, NGOs that are dedicated to transparency of corporate architecture and corporate power. The only place that people seem to be interested at all in corporate power is where it intersects with government power, which really just reinforces, you know, the whole focus on government power.
Right. And you see, that's so important because I think that that's been, as we sort of move to closing this up, that's been something that you have really focused on a lot. And it's very important And obviously, exposing NSA surveillance, exposing all of this, you know, all of these covert programs that have happened under basically the war on terrorism framework through Bush and Obama is incredibly important. But even as we look at, like, you know, the supposed reform bills in Congress to rein in aspects of the Patriot Act, well, first of all, obviously, they're incredibly limited and tepid reforms, but a lot of it is just sort of turning into, like, well, you know, government doesn't store metadata. Now the phone companies just will. And basically, yeah, first of all, yeah, government will have access to it whenever they want, regardless. And then, you know, this whole other question, which is that these companies whose whole sort of business model is built off of just incredibly sophisticated data mining, essentially, no one's talking about a sort of 21st century framework for consumer protections and for transparency and for how, you know, the sort of digital equivalence of putting seatbelts in cars. That conversation has been off the table because there isn't this scrutiny on corporate power, like you've pointed out. And then we have these anecdotes like, you know, Uber. Some people have taken shots at them, pretty minimal shots. And there you already have a CEO at a dinner saying, like, hey, maybe I should, you know, I should send some private detectives after people who say negative stuff about us.
That was my editor, actually, Sam Lacey. Yeah, yeah, it was Emil Michael, the executive there, yeah, saying he was going to put a lot of money, $1 million, into following and smearing her family, actually.
Right.
She's got two children. You know, no fallout from that. I mean, look, the Snowden, if you ask, the Snowden revelations, the most significant ones, and the ones I wish so badly that were followed up on, and I think a lot of other journalists do. Well, the Verizon one, you know, was big and great, and it confirmed, I think, the USA Today exposés in 2006. The Prism ones, the ones about Silicon Valley big tech companies, you know, working together with them, that to me was the big one. And that one, we haven't really heard anything about NSA. We've heard very little about NSA in tech since then from the documents. We've heard nothing about contractors. And, you know, we know from Tim Sherrock that 70% of the NSA is already privatized. 70% of the budget outlays go to contractors for the NSA. So it's more of a private organization than a public one. And, you know, part of that obviously is so that people can make money. And part of that is also when you have this murky public-private thing, accountability and legal accountability become themselves that much more murky. It's disappointing that so much of the story has since, you know, just almost exclusively focused on big bad government. The government, obviously, in this case is bad, but it's not. You're not really getting the story. It would be at least as bad if they only went after the companies and said nothing bad whatsoever about the NSA, and only went after sort of like the companies that were doing something. I don't know why that's the case. It's hard for me to believe that out of the tens of thousands of documents, there's not more about contractors in there. We just don't know. I mean, I don't know why we don't know more about that. It's just a big part of the story that seems to be missing, and hopefully it'll still come out. And it's a big part of the story in general that we're missing, I think, as, you know, that journalists aren't writing enough about. And again, because it makes their life a lot harder, the corporate private side of all this stuff. It's just a lot harder to do it. You have a lot more legal and sort of career roadblocks when you write about corporate power and when you challenge corporate power than you do if you write about government. I mean, you know, as a journalist, it's easier culturally for people to understand these days, the villain and the good guy. But more importantly, it's just easier to get it past your editor. They're not going to worry about getting sued out of existence if they write about government malfeasance compared to corporate malfeasance.
Absolutely. And just, you know, as a final thought, because I a lot of this still also definitely goes back, and we've talked about the how this sort of, you know, the Scientology of politics, which is how I talk about libertarianism, has kind of like, you know, defined so much of our era. And, you know, this is the problem. I mean, practically speaking, and just even like civically, I'm, you know, I think building coalitions and where you can work with people on intelligence reform and on prison reform is great. And I'm willing to work with libertarians on those issues and have conversations. But there is such a fundamental problem, because that coalition and that conversation is only going to deal with the governmental aspect of this. And as you point out, with the role of contractors, even practically speaking, it's not really going to rein in an out of control intelligence system. And then more broadly, it's going to do nothing to sort of lay the rules of the road for how we manage basically, you know, tech capitalism and 21st century capitalism. And that's the name of the game right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, and I think culturally we kind of just gave up on politics in some way in the late 70s or early 80s. And so, you know, I mean, liberals before then, certainly like liberals from the progressive era to the New Deal era, were a lot more attuned to, you know, corporate power and how coercive and destructive it could be. And I think because they were a lot more aligned with labor.
Right.
And so you understand these things a lot more. And, you know, you just think about it intuitively. I mean, the fear of what the NSA could do is, I mean, it's potentially, you know, Orwellian, absolutely Orwellian, what they could potentially do with all this information that they're getting. But in reality, the overwhelming majority of us are much more impacted by private technology, private sector surveillance, let's just say, surveillance and you know, the use of private information about our credit histories, which may or may not be true, or our reputations, our online reputations, which may or may not be true, and we can't FOIA to get access to this and have it change. And this may affect our ability to, you know, buy a car or to get a job or to get health insurance. You know, all these things actually affect our mundane lives, but it's less sexy than the possibility of an Orwellian, Big Brother state, like creating the sort of movie set, you know, horror film atmosphere.
Right.
And so, you know, the dramatics are much bigger in the government. And then it's a lot harder to write about what the corporations are doing. It's harder to get it past your editors, and it's harder to write about, and it's harder to get information.
Well, Mark Ames, I really appreciate you doing it, and it's always fun talking with you, and always, it's great. I appreciate your time as always, man, and I'll talk to you soon.
Cool. Thanks for having me
on. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, we're back. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Always stuck with me. Very interesting dynamic. The journalist that courageously stands against the government, you know, is a story we all know, but the ones that go up against hey, Matt, the ones that go up against corporations find it a bit more difficult. But hey, Matt, how's it going?
Oh, we are on. Look at that. Hello, yeah. Mr. Leck. How you doing today?
I'm doing okay. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay, too. I guess okay is a good way to just describe everything right now. Just okay.
We're maintaining.
Definitely. It is great to be here on this show today. You know, as great as it can be. Mm-hmm. It's okay to be here on the show today, I guess, would be the proper.
It's fine.
It's fine. It's a fine day. Yeah, right. For a fine show. And we're going to have fun in the second half of the show. I was listening to that Mike interview, and, you know, great interview as always from Michael. 2015, geez. One thing I noticed, though, on that interview was some great producing happening on that interview.
The levels were fantastic on that.
It was beautiful. I mean, really great.
I was taking notes.
Right. So, you know, that was for people who don't get the joke here. Shouldn't explain, but I think too many people are going to be, it's going to go over their head. That was a Matt and Mike show day back when I was doing the show with Michael in 2015. Not Matt Leck. Do you know this, Matt Leck? Have we discussed this before? I've mentioned it on my show recently. How there are way too many Majority Port listeners who jumped in like 2016, 2017, who think you are, I am you or you are me. And they get the both of us confused because I guess they just hear Sam yelling at a producer named Matt and don't notice that we have two distinctly different voices. I mean, I would say your voice is a little bit deeper than mine, a little bit.
I'd say, yeah, very different speech patterns and all that stuff. But yes, I have noticed that. That's a big thing, a problem in podcasting, because actually David Griscom and David Slavik get confused as the same person all the time as well on TMBS.
You know, there should be a rule that if you're having a podcast or even a live stream show, apparently, you can't hire people with the same first name at the same time or one in a row. There's got to be a gap in between.
There's a statute of limitations on naming rights.
Right. Absolutely.
And our voices.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's Jamie.
Hey, Jamie.
Oh, hey, guys. See, that's why I'm so, you know, shrill and full of vocal fry all the time. You know, it's not for my own benefit. I just want people to be able to tell when I'm talking.
Right. Of course.
I think I'm a vocal fry defender. It is very strange to me to see people really. I remember me and Mike were doing Two Dope Boys, we would occasionally have guests that would have vocal fry, and the complaints you would get about that, like, folks, just, I don't know, listen to it faster or something. Right? How is it that annoying?
People just don't even understand what it is, right? Like, I'm sure that I do some annoying things with my voice, but vocal fry is not usually one of them, and it just seems like a catch-all term for, like, lazy misogynists who want to complain about a woman.
I can tell you right now, I hear zero vocal fry in Jamie's voice.
It's a weird panic that happens when certain women get their voice goes a bit lower and you can hear it. I can't do it right now. Can you do it, Jamie?
Hey, guys, how you do today?
Yeah, posting is praxis.
Yeah, there you go.
That's
there
what vocal
go.
Fry is.
That's right. Classic.
And like, it's not, you know, whatever. I guess, like, the subjectivity of what voices are good and bad, I think, is a bit silly. And I think we should just accept everybody, no matter how they've learned to project their voice.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Deal with it, folks.
So I think, Jamie, I think we're about to go into the fun half now. And I believe, I know you and I did the show. Sam asked me to fill in for him on a fun half in the beginning of the year in January before the world went to S-H-I-T. I don't know if I could curse in the first half. you did the show with me, but apparently this is your first time co-hosting officially?
Yeah. I mean, I've sat in the co-host seat before, but I've never been entrusted to set up a clip before. So this is
getting her wings
a very
today.
Exciting day for me. I wish it was under better circumstances, but I'm happy to see you, Matt.
I want to explain to you how this is going to work, though. You see, because it seems to be something that happens with me when I co-host with people. In about 2 years' time, you're going to be insanely successful. You're going to have thousands of Patreons. You're going to have a touring live show. You're going to have hundreds of thousands of YouTube subscribers. And, you know, and I'll be filling in here still, apparently, whenever Sam needs me.
Well, it sounds like we both got a great life ahead of us.
Right.
So, how are you? Do you have an actual green screen there, Matt?
I do have an actual green screen, yeah.
I had to invest in one of those, I think.
Right. It's very nice. I'm not going to plug a brand without them paying us, but
no.
There is a company that makes one that just pulls up from the ground. It's like a roll-up green screen. Oh. And you just push it back down, and it rolls up into a little machine, and that's it. You don't got to keep it hanging up. You don't got to roll it out and set it up with the stands and everything. Hmm. It takes 5 seconds. It's pretty great.
I got to get one of those for my Zoom parties.
Right. There you go. Yeah. So if you're not watching on YouTube, you would think I'm sitting in the studio right now in Brooklyn because there is the studio backdrop behind me.
Yeah, we'd think the lighting was a bit messed up, but...
The lighting is a bit messed up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Messed up, yeah, it's not. I guess it's not. Right. Well, all I did, to be honest, was the last time I was at the studio, when no one was sitting in front of the backdrop, I just took a picture of it. And I was like, this might come in handy one day. I was assuming for like... a joke or something. Little did I know. Yeah. I mean, I used it. This isn't the first time I used it. Sam had me on to talk about QAnon stuff a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's very handy. People are going to feel, you know, a sense of home is important to, I think, a lot of people in our community right now. So,
those squares, you see them, it's like a warm blanket in your mind.
Yeah.
Now, is Sam, when Sam does the show, because I don't know actually, when Sam does the show now, I'm assuming he's still not in the studio. Does he use a green screen, or did he bring the backdrop?
He's got the exact same. He just has different backdrops, but he has one. It's, you know, that backdrop is just like an IKEA room divider with some lights and gels behind it. I guess we're giving away trade secrets.
Not to demystify,
here. Yeah, not to demystify it, but that's what that is. So he just simply bought another one of them and put lights behind.
He built a replica upstairs.
Yeah, but
it was
a long time coming,
but it came.
It came at the right time because he was finishing up right about the time that coronavirus hit, and people, I think people don't really recognize that he's not in Brooklyn anymore.
Or Sam knew something before everyone, and we should be investigating Sam Cedar.
Well, there's also the case that Sam's been a prepper since before I think either of us knew him. So.
Or again, what did the Chinese government tell Sam?
# Sam knew. He was telling us to take it seriously, like pretty much before anyone else, I gotta say.
Right. Oh, I mean, yeah. The part of Queens I live in is, you know, a lot of Chinese and Korean immigrants, and mask wearing around here is quite normal even before all this. But when I saw like the store, like restaurants and stores around here started to like hunker down early on before the rest of the country, even the rest of New York did. So, you know, I was sort of maybe not as early as Mr. Prepper Sam Cedar, but I definitely knew something was going on and something was off.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, when Sam warns me about a disease before I get like 5 concerned texts from my mom, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, Sam had a stock of like rice in like December, I think, when he heard the first reports of this.
He's got those apocalypse buckets.
Right. Yeah,
you wonder where those went after you tried to eat them.
Right.
I would starve. I would rather starve.
Speaking of coronavirus, maybe we should play this clip. You know, I don't know if the audience knows, but today we're not going to play this clip, but it's a good lead into all this. The coronavirus is apparently ravaging the conservatives who don't believe in coronavirus. The news broke today that Herman Cain, the pizza magnate who ran for president in 2012, Mr. The 999 plan, passed away after like a month-long fight against coronavirus, which, you know, whether you like the guy or not, it's sad because it didn't have to happen, because the guy was literally taking pictures at Trump's big Tulsa rally, not wearing a mask, where the rest of the crowd wasn't wearing a mask. And the timing in which he got sick shortly after, I mean, we don't know for sure, but it matches up pretty closely to the rally. And this was a guy who was tweeting about not wearing masks and how, you know, mask wearing was authoritarian and taking away his liberties or whatever.
Tweets they deleted this morning.
Yeah, they deleted.
Oh yeah, those tweets are hilarious, by the way.
Right.
Do you have them?
There's a few of them.
I put it in the Slack.
We could talk more about. Oh, here we go. Herman Cain, masks will not be mandatory for the event. Talking about the Trump Tulsa rally on July 1st, which will be attended by President Trump. People are fed up. And it comes with a link to Western Journal, where the South Dakota governor, also a Republican, proudly was pronouncing that there will be no social distancing at Trump's big Mount Rushmore independence rally. Oh, so Herman Cain was talking about that one. But the audio I have here, I want to play first. Now, this is the audio from a recent episode of Charlie Kirk's show. I believe Sam might have already played this on the fun half of the show a day or two ago, but we're going to play this in the first half now. Here's Charlie Kirk of Turning Point USA, the premier youth group for the conservative movement in the United States. Here's Charlie Kirk, who heads up that group and founded it, on the coronavirus and mask wearing.
Do not force me to wear a mask. It's that simple. I'm not going to do it. I'm not. The only time I comply is on the airlines, because I actually need to fly the airlines to be able to do my job and travel the country so I can deliver truth to you and make an income and grow Turning Point USA. So that's the fight I do not fight. But every single time I go into one of these grocery stores, where's your mask? I say, well, first of all, the science around masks is very questionable. Very questionable. In fact, some people, some doctors think that masks actually make you sicker and have you less likely to be able to get oxygen and more likely to infect yourself and less likely to be able to fight the virus and actually more likely to be able to die sooner. A lot of people believe that. I've met many doctors that hold that view.
And Congress,
secondly, we have a huge civil liberty issue here. Why do you have the authority to tell me what I can and cannot do with my body? I thought it was my body, my choice. I thought that was the entire thought process as to why we are wrongly able to terminate a million children in the womb every single year. And so I just don't like being told what to do generally by the federal government. I'm not a type of person who plays well when the government comes in and starts to just say you must put this on your face. Now, I think there's some restrictions that I support. I'm actually in the minority. I support seatbelt laws because I think seatbelts actually save
lives.
That's the
minority.
And I actually think it's not that big of an infringement on your liberty. I kind of disagree with a lot of people on this. I mean, some super strict libertarians say, oh, no, seatbelts ever. Okay, if you fly through the window of the car because you didn't want to wear a seatbelt and all of a sudden I have to pay for your health care, that's ridiculous. A mask might not even work. A mask is questionable at best. So the science around masks is needs to be debated more. And the fact that these Republican governors are like, oh, you must wear a mask, you must wear a mask, I think it's nonsense. I don't think it's popular. I have never met anyone that says, I just love wearing my mask. I love it. Yeah, I mean, okay, I am not a fan. I think it's dehumanizing. When I see a four-year-old wearing a mask, I can't think but help. We have let them down, and we have robbed them of their childhood.
Yep.
I mean, that last part's true, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, true for the wrong reasons.
Right. Well, one thing that's not questionable and not up for debate is this news that broke last night where Bob Montgomery, the 80-year-old who co-founded Turning Point USA with Charlie Kirk, who you just heard from, passed away from coronavirus complications.
Bill Montgomery, we should say.
Bill Montgomery, excuse me. Bill, I'm sorry, Bill.
Bill is the guy who Charlie Kirk didn't go to college because Bill got to him first and said, hey, don't go educate yourself. You're good enough already. What you need to do is go spew lies about higher education that you've never really experienced. Let's make lists of teachers. Let's just... the funny thing about Charlie Kirk, do you remember when he wasn't the Trump guy? Like, he's writing a Trump, a MAGA book now, the MAGA mindset or something like that. But he was a Ted Cruz guy. And when Trump tweeted out the picture of Heidi Cruz looking ugly, which is the thing that happened in 2016, he said that people aren't going to like this and this is the end of Donald Trump. But, but it was just the start of Charlie Kirk, so...
Then he became friends with Don Jr. You know, it's not so easy of a grift if you are a anti-Trump conservative. The market's very small and it's already been taken up by a few major power players. Much easier grift to run if you just go full on board with the MAGA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's go to the fun half of the show now. And we're going to have fun in the fun half of the show, right, Jamie?
Sure, always.
And before that, though, we should take a moment to promote all the fine people you hear on this show and what they do, their side projects, their own shows. Matt, what's your show? What's your podcast? I'm sure the audience has heard it a million times, but let them know again.
So of course, Literary Hangover. I'll probably be doing a stream this weekend, I think, after a bit of an absence. And there'll be new episodes coming up soon once we reformulate how the workload is going to be split for carrying on the other show that I work on, TMBS, which will be continuing. And if you want to help continue that project, go to patreon.com/TMBS. We did a good memorial show on Tuesday night. Still got my Michael Memorial, prayer nylon on. We're definitely going to keep things moving. So that's what I would like to point people towards now, patreon.com/TMBS.
Well, if you need someone with the same initials to help carry on that show, Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be happy to. I'm not going to say me because I wouldn't dare ever.
Well, TMBS says you would fit the TMBS, the Matt Binder show.
Right. No, I've actually let Michael know that when he was here, I let him know that he backed me into a corner because I couldn't call my show the Matt Binder show because he had already called dibs on the TMBS acronym.
There's too much name.
Just had to get a little creative.
Too much name parallelism going on. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, he seems to have backed you guys in a corner too. Maybe he meant to do that, actually.
Yeah. Like, if I randomly drop dead, this show is finished. Nobody else gets to have
Antifatis. The project is over.
Oh, no. I was talking about Michael.
She's saying if it was Michael saying that, the Antifada could, I mean, anyone could really
I did not name my show after myself on purpose for just that reason.
Right. So, well, Jamie,
that's a specific reason.
What is your show? Let people know. I mean, I'm sure, again, they've heard, they know it's the Antifada, but you should promote it again.
Yes. So this week on the Antifada, we had on Wilfred Chan, who's a contributing writer to The Nation and a member of the Lao San Collective, leftist internationalists out of Hong Kong. And we talked about the uprisings in Hong Kong. And this is a subject that I was a little bit scared to tackle at first because I know it's somewhat controversial on the left. A lot of people think it's too complicated or tough to generalize. But I was like, you know what? If I had talked to Michael about it, he would have told me to go for it. And I want to get more international and I want to understand what's happening in the rest of the world. So we talked about the history of anti-colonial struggle in Hong Kong, struggling against the British, to their rejection of being China's neoliberal window to the world that China uses to trade with the rest of the world. And we go forward in time to some of the contemporary lessons that the international left can draw from this movement, as well as, you know, we didn't shy away from discussing some of the more reactionary elements in this contradictory movement. So I'm proud that I did that. It's out now. Check it out. Patreon.com/theantifada.
Damn, Jamie, you are a promo machine. Look at that. Oh. Just was that prepared or just off the cuff?
Oh, I consulted the podcast description a little bit and ad-libbed a little bit, but thank you. You know, I watched Michael do it for a number of years, so I feel like I can do it too now.
I can tell you that after working with Michael for 4.5 years, zero of it has rubbed off on me. But all right, Brendan, do you have anything to promote? I actually have no idea if you have anything to promote.
Just the Majority Report. We got a bunch of great interviews coming up next month.
The company man.
Yeah, wow. Get my gold ring in a few years.
Well, he can't play shows right now, so this is all Brendan has.
Ah, Brendan, you got a band?
I do, yes.
Like, wait, drop that. What's your band?
We're called Means and Ways, and we're working on a few EPs right now. But
what kind of music?
More of a passion project. Good old rock and roll, Matt Bender. You heard it here.
Just classic old rock and roll.
I don't know. You know, when the music comes out, you guys can make that determination for yourself. I don't want to overdescribe anything.
All right.
On a scale from 1 to 10, how groovy is your vibe?
The vibe is groovy. I don't know. Not putting that on a scale.
Ooh, I'm already judging it. I'm already judging
the
it.
The other music that Brendan likes, I'm going to say their biggest influences are The Grateful Dead and maybe Fish. And
No. See,
I feel like Brendan's got strong opinions on Fish. All right, my bad. I don't want to disrespect your culture.
All right.
Oh, well, yeah, Bender, you love, like, metal and stuff like that. You would not like my band.
No. Actually, I mean, some metal I like. It's got to be, like, more grimy sort of... you know,
deep.
Yeah. Well, this year, thank you. My show is called Doomed. I'll get to that in a second.
Giving you a transition here.
Like punk, crust punk, you know, hardcore punk, straight up New York hardcore, anything like that. Oh, there's some like, you know, like, I guess like, you know, Municipal Waste is like a good, like, metal, but they're like, you know, fast sort of like, all right, well, we can talk about that more in the second half. Doomedpod.com is my podcast. But it's also, unlike the rest of the people on this show, but like the Majority Report, it's also a live stream, which means tonight at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time, you could go to youtube.com/Matt Binder and tune in live to watch my interview with Michael E. Hayden of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch, where we are going to break down his multiple, it was like a four-part series on Bumblejack Posobiec, I could never say his name. Oh, it's man. Polish, but you know him as Bumble Jack. He was the guy who claimed for a long time that he was a former CBS News journalist who became a MAGA guy. He's got over a million followers on Twitter. He's got a huge following. He's like a full-blown Trump guy. And Michael, my guest tonight, Michael Hayden, has uncovered a number of things about what this guy has claimed, including how his rise to popularity really stemmed from his ties to white supremacists. We will get into that tonight, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, youtube.com/Matt Binder, or you can subscribe to the podcast to catch it later. Doomed with Matt Binder at doomedpod.com. Catch it on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's what Sam says, right? I got that from Sam. A little bit of Sam's delivery rubbed off on me. I still find myself saying to this day, unbelievable at times. You know, I can't help it.
That's how Sam ends clips. Yep. Unbelievable. Yep.
Unbelievable.
It's shocking. It's shocking.
It's shocking. Right. Right. So
I appreciate it as the person who clips the videos. I could just go till Sam says unbelievable. Cut it off right before then and then get that up.
I would do the same thing.
Yep.
It's a good right. button.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you could see why he chose Matt Leck to carry on the Matt Binder producing flame, I guess you can say. All right, folks. We will now go into the fun half, the folks thing too. Jesus, I would never say folks before Sam Senior.
Folks.
All right. All right.
Yeah. Is it with an X or an LKS?
It's with an X for me. Folks, I guess, right? No, because I hold the S. So it is with a KS, I guess. Anyway, this is probably not, this is more fun half conversation. Yeah, let's go to the fun half. Michael Brooks, my friend, I love you very much, buddy. Hope we do you proud on the fun half of this program. All right, here we go.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man. The
alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back. Back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
Have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck 'em.
fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. My birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Pussy.